The Ensemble podcast is intended for professional financial advisors. This content is created in partnership with our sponsor, Morningstar IM, ABN 54071808501, AFSL 228986, and Franklin Templeton Australia Limited, ABN 76004835849, AFSL 240827, and is limited to publicly available information. Before acting on any general advice, you should consider whether appropriate and obtain financial advice from a qualified financial advisor. Ensemble does not hold an AFS license and does not provide any financial advice or services, or endorse any general advice. If a PDS or IM exists, you should obtain a copy and review it thoroughly before making a decision.
How are you now? And welcome to the Ensemble Investment Podcast. My name is James Whelan, VFS Group Investment Manager, and I'm here to represent you, the humble advisor, doing their best to walk the line between client interests and asset class selection. We're trying to find the things that are not only appropriate, but that are actually working to be in the right things at the right weight for the right clients. So get set, because myself and Morningstar are going to do our absolute best to answer some of the questions that have come up over the Ensemble platform. All the information contained is general in nature. So here we go.
Morningstar Investment Management Australia is delighted to be sponsoring Ensemble's investment podcast series, designed to equip advisors to have more meaningful conversations with clients. Morningstar Investment Management is a global leader in asset allocation, investment research, and portfolio construction. Specializing in investing, behavioral coaching, and practice optimization, Morningstar strives to give advisors the tools to confidently navigate their clients' complex needs. Morningstar, empowering investor success. This podcast is proudly brought to you by Franklin Templeton. At Franklin Templeton, we value the power of partnership and offer our clients a gateway to investment excellence. We bring together leading investment managers with specialized capabilities, providing investors access to a broad range of fixed income, equity, alternatives, and multi-asset strategies through one trusted global partner. Above all else, we always stay true to our commitment to create better financial futures together. Connect with us today at franklintempleton.com.au.
How are you now, and welcome to the Ensemble Investment Podcast, brought to you by Morningstar. My name is James Whelan, Managing Director, Barclay Pearce Capital's Wealth Management Team, and I'm here to represent you, the humble advisor, doing their best to walk the line between client interest and class selection, asset class selection always. We're trying to find the things that are not only appropriate, but that also work, and maybe try and find the right time to be the right weight for the right clients, that beautiful holy trinity. So get set, because myself and Morningstar are going to do our best to answer some of the questions that have come up on the Ensemble platform, and obviously all the information contained is general in nature. So here we go. We have talked about the fixed income market before, and it has been talked about many times before. We're not the first podcast to talk about the bond market or the fixed income market. Don't worry about that. We're not Robinson Crusoe out there. But its importance to the markets, and it's important to everyone's day-to-day, and the longer that I spend in this industry, the more I realize that the importance is there, and that I also realize this, and my old equities mates are gonna hate on me about this. The more I spend in this market, the more I realize the irrelevance of a lot of the day-to-day moves in the equities market compared to the importance of the smallest flap of the butterfly wings of the bond market. And a lot of my new bond friends will probably love that I've said that as well. So, you know, some tables I'll be invited to and some I probably won't be after I've just mentioned that. As mentioned, this is a follow-up podcast to the previous episodes that we have spoken about before, and I believe the initial one on fixed interest goes back to the beginning of October. So check in the Ensemble platform for that one, on that one, for the original required learning. It's not really required learning. We're going to touch on a few of the things I mentioned back there, just generally sort of following up on where things are going, because we've got bond experts here. So why not do that? So this will also focus, just so that the educational parameters are set, this will focus on some of the more definitions of things that go on, the way that the fixed income market moves, and what we're then going to achieve, guarantee you, is how to use the minutiae in those moves in the fixed income market to assist in portfolio allocation, assist with you and your discussions with clients. That's what we're all about here. Don't forget that more of these questions coming into the Ensemble platform, the better. Everything that you need to know is on that platform and always will be. Thank you very much for the questions that we've got. We are going to get to the questions that you have asked about the fixed income market. We're going to get to some of the updates that we need to have as well. We have a lot to get through today, so we're going to make this as quick as possible. Fortunately, like I said, we have an expert on the minutiae and an expert in portfolio allocation, so we can handle both of those two things we need to take care of. And I couldn't ask for two better names with me today. Then Matt Wacher, CIO for Asia Pacific at Morningstar, joins me to help steer the ship today, and there is quite a bit to work through. Matt, how are you now?
Good, thanks, Jimmy.
Beautiful. Absolutely cracking day. I don't like to give a date on these ones, but it's really good to be in here and talking to you guys as well. And joining him is Investment Director at Brandywine Global Investment Management, Richard Rauch. Richard, how are you now?
Yeah, really good. Thanks, James.
Yeah, first time on the Ensemble podcast.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm with a couple of veterans, which is exciting.
Oh, I just make it look casual. Any room I'm in, I'm doing okay with those sorts of things. I don't know what I'm talking about in this space at all, which is good. And that's what's good with me is that I always go into a thing, eyes wide open, explain this to me like I'm a 42-year-old male who's managed to just bluff his way through all bits and pieces of the industry. But it also gives me advantage of saying, you know what, I don't necessarily know everything. It is possible to run a wealth management company not knowing every single thing, but it's very important to know who knows and how to ask them and how to be able to retain that information and be able to use it to guide strategy. That's sort of my gift, if I could say. Some things I can do well, some things I can't. That's why it's great that I've got you two here in front of me so that we can start to bounce around. So we've got an overview of the last, or maybe not an overview of the last podcast on fixed interest, but let's just have a look at some of the things that we talked about, or some of the key points that were raised in the last one, or maybe just go around the grounds for a bit of an update on them. Now, I'm just going to throw them out there. Anyone who wants to put their hand up about what's going on, then go for it. There were Chinese data issues, not just on the last podcast. Trust me, there's been Chinese data issues for as long as I've been in markets. And there was some difficulty with the EM allocation that was done in the bond market because of it. Anyone got an update on China specifically with an allocation, fixed interest allocation in China?
Okay, I mean, I think I can talk maybe a little
Thank
bit.
Thank you, Matt. I'm just introducing us. Matt from Waystar. Got to get the voices right. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, property is still a very big issue in China, but I think lots of the data points seem to be starting to bottom out. Maybe that's manufactured, maybe not, but you're starting to see some sort of bottoming in macroeconomic data. You know, I think that there's still a lot of risk in China, but you know, there's some attractive valuations there as well from a bond specific perspective. I'll let Richard give his views, but
well, yeah, I mean, the first thing I would say is for the first time in a number of years, Brandywine Global has actually made an allocation in our portfolios to Chinese bonds.
Goodness.
Which is pretty interesting. I mean, data's been pretty weak. China's been exporting deflation to the rest of the world, which is interesting. And the bond market's been performing pretty well. But one of the key points from a bond investor's perspective is China's actually a pretty big part of your benchmark now. If you're in the global ag or the world government bond index. So to not own it is kind of a pretty big active call right now.
Yeah. And we have spoken about active and passive that we could talk about. So we're not going to go back over that specifically. But yeah, you're right. You better be making that up from somewhere else and making it up good. Because if you're missing out on China, how much weighting is it on a standard benchmark?
It's close to 10%, depending on the index,
yeah,
right?
That's enough to be.
So, you know, we'll get into this in terms of what that means from a risk perspective. Market value isn't the best measure of risk in fixed income, I think, as we know. But also the broader EM allocation. Used to get a lot of yield going into China. Now, not so much. And we could talk about where we're getting yield in other EMs right now.
Yep. Do you want to go into that now?
I mean, sure.
Well, it's the update is the EM allocation to bonds, so we may as well talk about that. I'm fascinated as well.
Yeah. So, look, Brandywine Global is a value shop, right? And one of our measures of value is real yield. So, what is real yield? That's the yield, the nominal yield minus inflation, some measure of inflation, whether it's trailing inflation or expected inflation. So that real yield, focusing on high real yields, is really what matters to us from an investment perspective. So we'll just break down the entire global bond market and really just rank every market from a real yield perspective. And that's a good starting point, right? And if you did that, I don't know, 3 years ago, 90% of the market would be negative, right? A negative real yield.
Yeah.
You know, we joke about Japan sometimes because there's such a low yield for so long. But its real yield actually wasn't that bad because inflation was so low going back 3 years ago.
Yeah.
But now the rest of the world is really, you know, really the nominal yields on pretty much every market around the world have gone up tremendously. You're seeing some really juicy real yields, especially in EMs. So if we do that ranking, like, I don't know, probably everything in the top quartile would be in the emerging world. And so the areas we like the most right now would be in Latin America. So markets like Brazil, Mexico, Colombia, for example. So these are countries and markets. There are a few benefits going on here. You know, one would be like Mexico, the whole friendshoring initiative with the U.S. So there's like a positive fundamental story. It's an investment grade market. But a lot of these countries, like, they didn't wait to have a balance of payments crisis this time around to start hiking rates, right? They started hiking rates well before the developed world, well before the Fed did. And they're on the other side now. Inflation's coming down. They're starting to cut rates in the case of places like Brazil. So not only are you getting strong bond market performance, but you're getting the tailwind of the currency. Yeah. So that's kind of the investment thesis on EM in Latin America.
I do like it when you get that currency that you can juice out a little bit more than 100% in a portfolio because of the currency that's in there. And it's not, this should not be discounted about how badly an investment can go for you if you get the currency wrong as well. Mm-hmm. It's nice to be in both directions there. What have you got on the EM side?
Yeah, I mean, I think in aggregate, we think that EM debt, mainly local currency, is still attractive. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got smaller allocations than we did 6 months ago. We've reduced it a little bit just because real yields in other areas are starting to juice up a little bit. But still, as Richard said, still a very attractive part of the market to be taking some of our fixed income exposure.
Not bad. Okay, well, there's a few ideas that can come out of the back of that, and I suppose we'll try and maybe get them onto the Ensemble platform so with some specific ideas. In fact, you know what? I'm going to say that we will have a special little chat thing set up on this one with some of these ideas that are coming up too. I'll get Danny Yell working on that as quickly as we can. Now, let's talk about spreads. The conversation on spreads and why spreads are important was mentioned in the last podcast. How have spreads changed? I'm going to say, are spreads still important? Like a dumb question like that. Obviously, they are. I'm just going to let you run with that, Richard.
Sure, they are. Yeah. They're tight. They've gotten tighter.
Yeah.
So what does that mean, right? It just means your compensation for default risk has gone down, right? Does that mean defaults are going to be lower? Maybe, right? That could be one reason. But they've really just had this constant grind lower to the point where, I don't know, if you just throw around some numbers, the global investment grade corporate bond market's trading at about 100 basis points, roughly over risk-free treasuries. Yep. High yield is around 300. So both of those are historically tight.
Yeah.
So you're not really being compensated for that default risk relative to history. However, this is the big caveat with credit and what a lot of institutional investors would point out. The yield matters too. And the yield is actually quite juicy in various parts of credit markets. So you can get 8, 9, 10% yields on like a short dated high yield security, depending on the sector. That sounds pretty darn good, right? When you're not really taking that much, you know, spread volatility risk, spread duration.
Yeah, no, I would agree. They are very tight. You are getting pretty good yields. I guess you got to weigh up, well, for a risk-free asset, I can get, whatever it is now, 4.5% for US 10-year, Aussie 10-year, or just below that, versus the extra 300 basis point for high yield. And you know, is it worth taking in a portfolio construction sense that risk, or can you just juice up your equity exposures at the same time and use the treasuries as a counterpoint?
Yeah, Richard?
Yeah, one other quick point that we've been looking at is there's also the dollar price, like the actual price of the bond or the series of bonds.
Yeah.
And that matters too, right? Normally when a bond's issued, it's issued at 100. It's issued at par, right? Well, because interest rates have gone up so much since 2022, the dollar price has fallen. We'll get into this.
We didn't
in a
get the caveat at the beginning. Sorry, now we got to do it, Richard.
Yeah, all right.
Oh, kill me. Okay. At the beginning and in every single article, and I've joked about this on podcasts that I've been doing ever since 2020 when COVID kicked in and nobody knew what zero interest rates actually really meant and what was happening in the bond market that was crazy. We noticed that every single article and every single piece that was written from something in the Daily Telegraph into the highest level article in the Financial Times, which should be the pinnacle of very, you know, good daily sort of research for anyone who's out there, always mentions at the end of a bond market report that yields and price move inversely. The higher the yield, the lower the price. When one moves up, the other moves down, and conversely as well. Now, Well, that was the specified time. Everyone take a drink every time I do that. One day we won't have to do that anymore.
Yeah,
not today.
Well, yeah, this is
okay,
Richard. This is what I call job security a little bit.
Yeah,
The fact that this is a confusing asset class, the terminology is confusing, prices and yields go in opposite directions. So
yeah, just talk like normal people. I've been saying this for a long time. Sorry, go on.
So going back to the point, so the actual dollar price of these securities has fallen quite a bit.
Yep.
And in some cases in the high yield market could be like 80 cents on the dollar. Now, as the investor, that's actually a good thing because you have a big margin of safety, because if and when these things default, well, you usually get a recovery value mm-hmm. on the company. You know, they sell their assets, they go through bankruptcy and all that. And it's usually not zero. Sometimes it is. But on average, let's say it's 40, 50, 60 cents on the dollar. Well, if you have a security that you only bought at 80, well, you know, that's how much you've lost, between 80 and 60, not 100 to 60. So there's a big, big margin of safety.
Yuck.
And there's room for that to go back up to 100.
Yep.
Right? So you have the capital appreciation built in.
Yep, which it does, which again sort of just echoes and sings out how much better it can be being higher up on the stack, because when things sometimes do go wrong, the people who get paid out first, you know, the debt guys are always the guys who get paid out first. The equity guys are often back at the queue. Always back at the queue. Usually that's the way that it goes. Sorry, Matt.
No, I was going to say another reason to have a good active manager looking after your credit there, because they can really, security selection is really important in credit markets.
Absolutely. Absolutely. See previous podcasts regarding credit that we have mentioned as well. Now, I believe that we've gone through a record, and I'm talking US markets here. We've had the longest number of trading days consecutively with an inverse yield curve, talking about the 2/10. So now I think that we may have even been talking about this 6 months ago, that this yield curve, which is supposed to have predicted the recession that has just not happened in 2024. Richard, why don't you give us an update on the yield curve and why it will continue to not tell us that?
Well, it is still inverted,
yeah.
Right? And look, us at Brandywine, we're looking for valuation anomalies, right? And by definition, an anomaly doesn't happen all that often. But when it does, like, you need to pay attention, and that's how you invest a portfolio, right? I talked about value earlier. Well, the second piece is there a big anomaly? Well, the yield curve has been kind of this screaming anomaly for a while, right? And it is predictive. So it's going to normalize at some point, one way or the other. So it's either, you know, the short end of the yield curve is going to come down, or the long end is going to go up, or some combination of the two.
Yeah,
right?
Probably the last one. Yeah.
So what's happened, and this ties a bit into the macro view to some extent, is that, look, that relationship in terms of it being predictive of a recession has at minimum been delayed. It's been broken down because, especially in the US, growth has massively outperformed the rest of the world. It's outperformed a lot of people's expectations, probably including ours.
No doubt.
And a lot of that was due to the big fiscal impulse happening in the US, which has still been happening. And so, yeah, does the yield curve matter? Yeah, it does. I don't think the economy can operate forever, right? It's an abnormal environment. There's certain sectors that I don't think do well. This is why the Fed would love to cut rates. They'd love to. They're just not there yet with inflation.
Yeah.
No, I agree. I mean, I think that people have been very much expecting a recession in the US, especially bond managers. No offense, Richard, but it's just never come. And then I think the yield curve has been a key indicator of that. But as you said, growth and even the figures that we saw a couple of nights ago in terms of US unemployment, just the strength has been, you know, something that no one's expected. And so that yield curve has remained how it is. And I think, you know, some form of steepening isn't going to be too far away if we keep getting these kind of GDP numbers.
Yeah, it's been frustratingly long how all of this has actually taken to play out, and I think with a lot of people just talking about, I was in the stickier for longer camp, and I have been for a long time, especially with the whole transitory thing. I remember transitory was like the word of the year a couple of years ago, and I was just like, it's not transitory. This stuff sticks for a while, and I'm not an expert, and everyone sort of said, well, you're not an expert, so why don't you shut up? And anyway, here we are, and we're still sort of lagging along. Whilst food inflation has come down, and I have noticed that just recently that it has come down, that's good. But I think a lot of stuff has just been too sticky. We're now seeing oil oil and energy prices that just won't go away, depending on where you are in that. Anyway, that's all just me. If you've got anything to add to that, Carlos?
Yeah, the energy prices, oil price, that's a worry. That's a big worry. That often is a precursor for a reacceleration of inflation. But like our whole thesis around why this has taken so long, right, is because everything that happened post-pandemic, this has not been a normal cycle. Actually, we would argue it hasn't been a cycle at all. It's been a normalization of like a natural disaster, right? And if you view it through that lens, then the question is, okay, well, looking at normal macro data probably isn't going to help you out. You just need to wait for this normalization to finish, right? And most of this inflation fall we saw the last couple of years, it's actually just been a normalization of supply chains and other, you know, other factors. And everything that went up in sequence has kind of come down in sequence. That last little bit is very difficult to get under control, though, however.
That is generally accepted.
So now we're at the point where I think that normalization is basically done. Or there's a few things working themselves through, like the fiscal is probably the last one. But now that that's done, you can actually focus on what we like to focus about, which is the macro variables, growth and inflation and employment and all the fun stuff.
Yeah, which what happens next? Do you have an idea of, I mean, is it possible to get inflation back down under 2%?
Yes. The question is without a big recession.
That's the key. I mean, sometimes when the data point is so good, the only way for it to go is turn bad. I don't think we're quite there yet, but it's recession is still, you know, it's a card that's still on the table waiting to be played. At the same time, you know, this reacceleration of growth potentially is really something interesting that probably not many, as we've said, not many people were expecting.
It's difficult to look at the robustness of the US economy. I always direct my attention to the US. The Australian, our economy will always muddle through, as we've discussed 1,000 times before. It's difficult to look at the robustness of the US economy and think how a recession could even be something that's possibly within our 6 to 12 month outlook.
Yeah, it certainly feels that way.
Okay.
However, let me give you a data point. So, and look, I think it's fair to focus on the US. Granted, I have an American accent. I lived in Australia for a long time now. My wife's Aussie. My kids are Aussie. But the US, look, is first of all, the biggest engine of growth right now by far. Like Europe's basically in recession / sub trend growth. China's been deflating basically. Japan is basically in a recession. All the big economies, and we're kind of takers here in this part of the world of what's going on. So it is right, I think, right now to focus in on the US. But the data point would be look at US unemployment. This is why everyone's very focused on the jobs data, even the high frequency stuff. So unemployment's actually gone up about 500 basis points from the low, right? From the absolute low in the US.
Okay.
And that typically, if you look at pretty much every cycle that's ever happened, you never go up only 500 basis points. You go up a lot more than that kind of very quickly. So it is a bit of a worry that we've had that uptick.
Yeah.
But we're still at pretty low levels, right?
Yeah. It's just something that I've just got that is very, it's difficult for me to imagine, to envisage. And if you can't envisage it, then I just don't know where it comes into it. However, I mean, I didn't envisage an entire planet shutting down for a few months either. And then the ramifications of that, keeping in mind that the 210 bond yield, 210 curve had been inverted just before COVID happened as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It didn't predict COVID, but there was going to be a recession. It was right. No one could figure out how. So. Okay, do you think, now there was inflationary outlooks at the time, I did ask you, do you think that it's possible for it to get down below 2? Do you have a general inflationary outlook aside from that in the next, over the next 12 months or so?
Look, I think that it, you know, it, if I can say, it's trending down, but not trending down too much.
Yeah.
I think, yeah, as Rich said, a lot of the hard work has been done and actually, or maybe it's the easy work that's been done and the hard work is yet to come if it is to go down. And yeah, I think that people will feel some pain if the US want to get it down under 2%, which I'm not sure that they do, given the interest rate talk about interest rate cuts and those sorts of things. Then I think that recession is going to be really on the horizon. But I don't think that that's the case. But I think, you know, lots of the speak out of the Fed, et cetera, is that there are rate cuts coming. So I don't know how viable it is to get it below 2% in that kind of environment.
Yeah, I was sort of pontificating a while ago. It was about a year ago, going that they're going to find it so difficult to get it down below certain numbers that they've set that they're just going to reestablish their parameters for how they work and just stop talking about two.
It's good because they did that a couple of years ago. So,
well, I mean, as in, stop saying this is what.
Stop saying that's what we're going for, as opposed to the
actual rules under which they do. It'll just be like, it's fine.
Yeah,
we're just going to. I mean, but theoretically, what's to stop the Fed from just maintaining these numbers? They don't have to cut, do they?
No, they don't.
Yeah, that's exactly. They don't.
They don't have to. They don't have to. There's no need. There's no cause for them to have to do that. And remember, Powell said. Trying to think of when he said it. It was going in now almost maybe a year or so ago, and effectively sort of taking this in the context of which he was speaking. It was sort of one of these big earth-shattering things when he gave a speech. It was just like, we're not mucking around. We're not going to cut. And if the market doesn't like it, then, you know, yours. Don't know if we can use that. Yeah. Good. My producer just said, I can use slightly fruity language. Thank you. But to say that, and it was effectively saying, it's okay for us to push on and potentially break something because it's easier for us to fix something that's broken than it is to continue with this low rate environment. So deal with it, and that's what you're going to have to do.
Yeah, and they—I mean, Jay Powell or any central banker, you know, who do they remember? And yeah, they probably have a painting of him behind them in their office, which is Paul Volcker, right? And he's the hero of all the central bankers. They all wrote papers about this guy. They don't want to be Arthur Burns or whoever else who mucked it up,
yeah.
Right? They want to be the inflation fighters that got it right.
Yeah.
And so I think you're right. All of that said, I think they would acknowledge that policy is pretty tight, right? And you look at where real rates are in the U.S., like it is starting to have an impact depending on where you look in the economy. They don't want to be excessively tight at the wrong times. And I think that's why they say, okay, cuts are on the table. But what's preventing them from doing it 6 months down the track? Yeah, they might just keep kicking it out. I mean, Kashkari came out and said we might not cut at all, right? And the market didn't like that.
I mean, they kicked the can down the road for a long time the other direction. So it could be the same in reverse.
Yeah, they sure did, didn't they? And it's so funny to see that all the people who were just like, if you just like look at the growth, now it's time to sort of put it up. At least then you've got somewhere to go if the next thing happens, an either predictable event like a recession, which is a fairly predictable part of a cycle, or you have a black swan event that kicks up where you go, okay, we need to actually do something. It's easy to make that move from 5% than it is to do it from 2%. Anyway, that's me and that's my policy analysis, and I hope that they take that on board. Moving on. Okay, so now we got the questions that have come in off the podcast. So that's a good overview of what happened with the last one and where the updates are from the last podcast. Fantastic. Thank you very much for your help. Now, we've got some questions from our viewers, listeners, and advisor network that we've got out here going ahead. Is the bond market reset over? Or is the choppy ride likely to continue? I'm just going to ask these questions. Whoever wants to stab an answer at it can go ahead and stab an answer at it. Did you want to talk about... No, we'll get to that in a second. But did you want to sort of... We may have already mentioned it, but Richard...
Yeah, look, but let's just talk about bond market volatility for a second,
yep.
Right? So bond market volatility has been elevated. Depending on the metric, and these things aren't perfect, but one of the charts we like is... bond market vol versus equity market vol. And, you know, we look at, you know, the VIX, like options markets, and we look at the MOVE index and the bond market, and they've totally diverged, right? Equity market vol is way lower, has been way lower than bond market vol. Will that persist? Well, I think it likely will. And part of the reason is what I just said earlier, which is we're back to your regularly scheduled programming of macro data. Every macro release is potentially a big volatility event as people try to work out, are they or aren't they going to cut and when and how? And then the whole bond market will reprice as a result.
Yep. That was pretty much it. Now, we talked about bond market volatility. So we did want to say that the outcome of this podcast is to get some really good definitions and some education out of it. So let's just set the parameters around to what we're doing before I go into the rest of the points that are going forward. Let's define duration. Let's define convexity. And if you wanted to talk any more about, I mean, volatility is pretty obvious, but if you wanted to talk about volatility, go for that as well. So we've now put our educational corner hats on. Duration.
Okay, this is going to be fun, right? I did a educational presentation for colleagues on, I called it the dreaded duration session a number of years ago, because it even bamboozles the most sophisticated of investors or asset managers or colleagues or everyone. So let me try to break it down and then you guys can jump in. So duration, despite the word is confusing itself because it implies a relationship with time, and there is a relationship with time. But in a nutshell, duration is interest rate risk. So if I'm explaining this to my five-year-old, so if I say to my five-year-old, hey, you give me $1, I'm going to give you $1.50 in a week's time. Say, okay, that sounds good, Dad. Let's do it. Then I turn to his brother and I say, I'm going to give you $1, and in a week's time, I'm going to give you $2 back.
Mm-hmm.
Well, guess what? First of all, the first boy is not too happy, right, that he's getting the short end of the stick. But that basically, in a nutshell, is what interest rate risk is. That first loan that was made or that I was going to make had a lower rate, right? So, you know, as rates get higher, right, you want the rate that is higher and what you own is less valuable.
Yep.
So simply put, you know, it is interest rate risk. And so as rates go up, bond prices go down. There's a more complex math version of this where you're discounting future cash flows back to the present value. And so, you know, when you're discounting by a bigger number, you actually get a smaller number at the end. And so that would be my kind of intermediate definition of duration. And then probably the more complex, which is frankly just straight up mathematical. If you think back to your calculus class, this is the price yield relationship. So what is that relationship? Well, if it was a linear relationship,
yep,
then that would be a straight line. And the number would be the slope of that straight line. And it'd be the first derivative of that price yield relationship. And then moving on, if I haven't lost you already,
no.
Moving on to convexity.
You said, like, I guess,
yeah,
but like this is maybe more practical, but generally bonds that have a shorter time horizon have less duration and than a 2-year bond versus a 10-year bond.
Yep. So moving it, and I always sort of do it at the, I can break it down even sort of simpler than that. How big is the megaphone on the movement that happens with regards to the yield and price that they indicate?
That's right. Yeah,
good. Bigger megaphone, slow further out.
Yep.
Smaller megaphones, more closer to us.
Yeah,
exactly.
You can tell that I've been dealing with my guitar for my entire career.
But what people don't realize is it's an estimate. This is a straight line estimate of what the price will do if the yield moves one direction or another. To get real precision on this, you actually have to introduce new concepts. The main one would be convexity, because that relationship between price and yield, it actually has a curvature to it.
So
it's not linear.
So then the second derivative, like you just said, so what that line looks like, that will decide price yield movements, changes, and that changes convexity, i.e. either a convex shape or a concave shape, but is that line.
Exactly. Yeah. How fast that line will move.
That's right.
Okay. Yeah.
All right. We're good. And I checked this with you before.
Yeah.
I will say I did have to check this with you before. That I come from the old derivative space. Anyone in the derivative space who had to do their Greeks to pass their exams, duration is delta or like delta, and convexity is like gamma. So that's it. That's the way of doing it. Delta drives gamma. Price drives delta. Whatever it is you want to discuss in that. We're close enough.
Yeah, Matt. And again, if you need to protect your portfolio, having more duration and particularly more convexity in a portfolio potentially allows you to take more growth assets. So you've got that extra protection in a kind of multi-asset context.
Okay, so under the context that we now know what we're talking about in duration and where things are set, do you want to talk about where convexity is now, where duration is now, and just get straight into talking about where we'd be able to alter a portfolio, and I can sit back and have a big drink of water and just listen to the magic happen?
Sure. I'll kick it off. So over the last, I don't know, it's probably been going on for 25 years, the actual duration of the market, whether you're looking at the Aus bond composite or the global ag or whatever, in take your pick of the index, they've been getting longer. Basically, the interest rate sensitivity of the bond market that most people own has gone up a lot, right? Almost, you're basically like double of what the global ag was when I started my career. It was called the Lehman ag. That's how far back this goes.
Okay.
This only started rolling over a little bit after the pandemic. And the reason is simple. When rates got lower and lower and lower and lower, governments, corporates, you know, pretty much every entity just keeps issuing longer and longer and more debt. And therefore, the market's duration has gone up. So the market is actually quite sensitive to interest rate moves.
Yeah, yeah, had the Austrian government after issuing a 100-year bond.
100-year bond, wasn't it? Yeah, that came out. So with there being more longer-dated stuff, there you go. I'm just going to...
Yeah.
But so there's more longer data stuff, which means that the mega fund is really big at the end, which means any slight change here is going to affect that move. I just used hand signals for a podcast.
That's right, guys. If you own the market, right? You don't have to own the market, but if you own the market and the people, that's their neutral point. Yeah, 100%.
Okay.
I mean, there is the convexity element, and that is interesting, and it depends on the instrument. And without getting overly technical here, there are. Like anything that has options embedded in them, like mortgages or, some corporate bonds have call options and things like that. You know, there's some interesting things going on with the convexity of those.
Yeah.
But the overall convexity of the market, I think it lends itself to giving you more protection than it had.
Yep. Okay. Yep. So now with that in mind, Matt, how has that changed portfolio allocation?
Well, I think
you want to go back over the last 25 years.
If we just go back 3 years, kind of 2021, you know, bond yields very, very low. 2020, 2021, bond yields very, very low. And duration extremely high. Then you have a year like 2022 where bond yields rise and rise significantly and very quickly. That's why you have those losses that people experience in both the equity and bond markets at the same time in 2022. But now where we're at with interest rates, you know, at much more normal levels, you know, let's call it around 4.5%. And they've kind of traded over the last year between 4% and 5%. You know, that's kind of much more normal, and actually it gives you some diversification benefit. If bond yields were to rise significantly from here, you're probably going to get maybe another 2% or so if that scenario plays out. The yield is actually compensating you for that interest rate risk that's there at this point in time. So you're not going to lose as much as you did back in 2021, 2022. So if you have another backup in yields.
Without being too specific, but, you know, just giving us a general idea of where you could benefit from those particular changes, what would you have any particular area that you'd be discussing?
Look, I mean, I think from a multi-asset portfolio context, we're quite happy to own, as Australian investors, to own Australian government bonds, US government bonds, and developed market government bonds. If we want a little bit of alpha, we're certainly looking at emerging markets, but probably a little bit more than over credit, but we're happy to own some investment grade credit as well. I think Richard may differ from me here, but high yield, we really don't think we're being compensated for holding sort of higher risk credit in the portfolio at this point in time relative to government bonds.
Makes sense.
Yeah, I don't disagree. More broadly, in opportunistic portfolios, we don't own any high yield. For portfolios that are more credit oriented, we do, but at the short end. So it protects yourself from big movements in spread and to a degree default rates. Yeah, look, I mean, how we're building a fixed income portfolio, so we don't have all the levers of, you know, equities, commodities, cash, et cetera. We're still barbelling portfolios within the fixed income sleeve. That's how we're actively running it. Even though we're not like pounding the table that you need to be long duration versus an index right now, I think we would like to be highly convicted on that, but we just aren't. So as a result, it's more within fixed income. What do we own? So we like and are overweight U.S. treasuries.
Mm-hmm.
So we think there's good value in the U.S. and, you know, just the outright carry, if not some capital appreciation and that defensiveness in your portfolio. You want to have that as your ballast. And then on the other side of the barbell, okay, we don't own high yield credit or some of the higher risk credit securities. But we do own those Latin American emerging markets. We do own some mortgage-backed securities. So mortgages, big part of the global universe, actually, and they can be quite high quality. I think mortgages got a bad reputation from the GFC, but these are pretty high quality, pretty much no credit risk in certain parts of the mortgage world, right? And you're getting really nice yield and pick up from that. You're also getting a bit of duration at the right part of the curve.
I actually think that the GFC did a lot for the risking of those mortgage-backed securities, that end of the market, because it's effectively you can't make a mistake with that anymore because of what happened in the first time, and the fact that not enough people got strung up by their thumbs after the first one is that no one is going to get that excuse the second time around. Is it just me?
I agree.
Yeah.
Totally agree.
Yeah. I think one other aspect that we probably haven't spoken about, but it's very much linked to fixed income markets, is currency.
Yeah.
And and I'd say that, you know, from it being a multi-asset portfolio at the moment, especially as an Aussie dollar investor, we think, you know, the US dollar's probably fairly valued relative to the Aussie. But the yen, I think, is somewhere where, you know, we can get some diversification, extra diversification benefit.
Yep.
And it's really, we think it's really cheap at this point in time as well.
The yen versus the Aussie.
Yen versus the US dollar, but yen versus the Aussie in particular for us, because you get that, Aussie is more a risk-off currency.
So that would be being long Japanese bonds in an
Or yeah, or just the currency itself.
Just long the currency.
Yeah,
no, that's okay.
Given the bonds are...
It's good that we've got a fixed
interest. Probably the
least. Yeah, funny. I wasn't expecting to agree on so many things, but in this case, yeah, we actually like the yen too, but we hate the bonds.
Okay.
Right? So we're actually implementing that in a portfolio. We're just, you know, buying currency fours and going long the yen. Now that has been painful. I think we would acknowledge that has not worked recently, but the yen is at multi-decade levels of cheapness. And like I said, we're a value shop. In the medium term, we do think the dollar, the US dollar, will come down. Timing is critical here. I think most models would say the US dollar is overvalued. But look, there's been US growth exceptionalism, right? First, it was tech leadership. Now it seems to be AI driven or whatever else, fiscal, now the last couple of years.
Yep.
So the US and, of course, interest rate differentials.
Interest rate differentials. And we just said that they don't really have to be cutting anytime soon. Mm.
Yeah. However, currency, the way we think about it, it's the ultimate relative value, right? So for everything you're long, by definition, you're short something.
Yeah.
And so really, this is not about the US doing well or doing badly. It's about maybe the rest of the world just isn't quite as bad as it was, right? Maybe China surprised the upside. Maybe Europe surprised the upside only a little bit compared to the last decade, which has been pretty bad, right? For Europe in particular.
Relatively speaking, yeah. But I mean, the European market looks solid. I'm okay with the European economy here. PMIs will shift up into an upwards direction. This is a fixed interest. I'm not going to get on my soapbox about where my allocations are, so it's okay.
But as an active, so the way you build a bond portfolio, a currency, active currency, can be a really nice diversifier, a lever. It worries some people because currencies are notoriously very volatile and they're hard to get right. But if you have a longer term time horizon and you build it into your case for example, I was talking about emerging markets. Well, if you're going to own the Brazilian, you know, securities, or you're going to own Mexican on bonos, like if you're going to take that position on the bond, you really want the currency too, because hedging that out is very expensive. You're basically paying away all that extra carry that you're earning in those markets. So, you know, it's a way to get, you know, to boost your yield, to increase diversification, to have a lever that a lot of managers don't have.
Yeah. Now, how aggressively would you, so let's just take, so Matt, our allocation guy, in an aggressive portfolio, let's have a look at that. How much of an allocation would you want to be looking at for in these sorts of areas? What are we talking about for Brazil? 8?
In one of our portfolios, yeah, it would be like a 5% allocation.
Oh no, right? and the yield.
Oh, the yield. Oh yeah, the yield's like in the high single digits.
Yeah. Okay. Mm. Okay. So in an aggressive portfolio, say Morningstar.
Well, it's a really interesting question, because in an aggressive portfolio, you just want to have equity risk in there. Like, so if you've got an 80-20 or a 90-10 type portfolio, you might not have much room for emerging market debt or a high yield in there. But say for a conservative investor or a more moderate investor, you actually can take less equity risk there and have some emerging market debt.
Yeah.
So you might, similar kind of levels to what Richard was describing, but you might be able to juice up in a more risk effective way, get a better risk reward kind of profile for a lower risk investor.
Do you want to go into that for a second? I mean, as painful as it is to say that you've got someone who wants to go in an aggressive portfolio, theoretically under these amazing rules of portfolio allocation, I can't allocate them into a riskier bond portfolio, even though I'm fairly certain that that is actually a more aggressive way that they should be going into it and be able to get higher returns, which is supposed to be the goal. Is there a way, like you're saying, to get around this? Can you give equity risk premium without the equity risk, Richard? Yeah. Lead in. Beautiful. Did I give you the underarm throw? Yeah. Yeah, go for it.
I mean, the main point around fixed income is it's a broad church. This is not one homogenous thing, right? So if the whole point of your fixed income allocation, and we have a lot of, most of our business in Australia is institutional, right? So we know how they do portfolio construction. And some, you know, they want a portfolio that's going to be that defensive piece that's going to be their anti-equity, and they're not going to want much credit in that portfolio at all. Right. We then have others where this is their alpha sleeve, and that's where they want to add things like credit, emerging markets, and so on and so forth. So you solve it, I think, through product design, and we have multiple products, or you solve it at the asset allocation level, right? Just by saying, all right, I'm going to have, and then you have fee budget considerations as well, right? You have regulatory impacts in Australia in particular, where you've got to be conscious of the benchmark. You've got to be conscious about the fee. And so a lot of our clients are actually barbelling portfolios where they're saying, all right, I want to get some active risk. I'm going to get all my duration passively or through a core manager, and I'm still going to outperform by blending them together.
Yep. Yeah. What do you think of that, Matt?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. That's kind of what I was trying to describe very badly around aggressive portfolio versus a more conservative investor. You need to get alpha in both, and it's where you get that alpha is the key.
Okay, well, there's a few questions here to go, but most of them we've actually covered through the what we've talked about in this podcast so far anyway. So I think that I actually have to start closing this podcast off because we've been here for too long. Richard, have you got anything to close with on what you're seeing out there, what you'd like to talk about?
Like one last piece, which we didn't get too much into, is around cash versus bonds.
Yeah, and let's have time for that. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, I mean, one thing to leave with the listeners is that I try to remind people, like, the cash rate or the Fed funds rate or the RBA's rate is not the same as the bond yield. The bond yield actually is dictated by market forces all along the curve. Mm-hmm. And that is really what's going to drive the performance of our portfolio, your bond portfolio. Really doesn't have anything to do with the cash rate. Maybe there is a relationship. I wouldn't say it doesn't have anything to do with it. But you need to be more focused on the longer term macro variables or where growth and inflation are going to go. And because your starting point is so good, you're basically getting equivalent yields to cash markets with this big duration kicker that will come in at the right time.
And the right time will be if something does go wrong in markets, if there is that issue that we can't see on the horizon.
Yeah.
But if it comes, then bonds are going to help you much more than cash.
Yeah.
At this point in time, especially with real yields where they are.
Like I said, the longer that I spend in this market, the more I realize that I not wasted time, but probably should have had more energy devoted to that, the left side of the market, as I always think, on the risk curve. Very helpful to clients as opposed to just having the token allocation to it that you're required to have. I really think, yeah. But you can't go back and have your career again, can you? Do you want to have your career again, man? You've done all right.
Yeah, no, I've done all right, you know.
Yeah.
You could have done this, could have done that.
Yeah, we could have done a lot of things. Thank you for joining us, Matt Weish, CIO for Asia Pacific and Morningstar. Cheers, Matt. Good on you.
Thanks, Jimmy.
And absolutely fantastic having investment director from Brandywine Global Investment Manager, Richard Rauch. Thank you, Richard.
Great. Thanks for having me.
All right. You've joined myself, James Whelan, Managing Director of Barclay Pearce Capital's Wealth Management Team, for another amazing Ensemble Investment Podcast brought to you by Morningstar. Any questions, please put it through on the Ensemble platform and I'll be happy to answer them for you. We'll set up a little chat group with some of the discussions on this one. If you need someone else to describe duration and convexity to you, I think that I might be able to do it, but I have to use my hands and I can't not do that. So that's it. Our producer, Kieran Millwood, thank you very much, everyone, for joining us. Have a great one.